You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiotakis. It all began a half century ago. A strip club called Largo on the Sunset Strip changed owners and became the Roxy Theater. The first act to play that intimate room was a young musician who'd been on the scene for a few years named Neil Young. He played a bunch of songs that would be put on the album Tonight's the Night. Last week, exactly 50 years later, Young was back to kick off the Roxy's 50th anniversary, playing some of those same songs. It's been 50 years since he played that song, and he did it last week. In the years since, the club has witnessed a who's who of rock luminaries from The Boss, Bruce Springsteen, and Bob Marley, The Clash, and the incomparable Ricky Lee Jones, who's here to talk with us today about the Roxy and the 50th anniversary of the club. Hey, Ricky Lee, thanks for coming on.
Hey, yo, yo.
Yo, yo.
I'm so glad to be here.
Well, yeah, you first played in 79, which wasn't quite 50 years ago. Talk a little bit about the scene in L.A. in the late 70s along the Sunset Strip.
Sure. There was the Whiskey, which was doing more rock kind of things. I saw Blondie there in 78, I think, and there was the Roxy. There was the Troubadour, which had fallen into disrepair, and the folk players had left it, and anybody, any comer was welcome. So heavy metal and then punk had seeped in and taken it over. So that was kind of it. As far as an elegant place or a place for a singer-songwriter, if I could say that, the Roxy was the only game in town as far as I was concerned.
It was the only game in town. I mean, from what, and just having been there myself, it's not a very large venue. It's a very intimate venue slash theater. And when you look at it, you know, a lot of other places were actually bigger, right, and less intimate.
Well, you know, I had seen Loudon Wainwright III. And when I went to see him, it seemed like the biggest room I ever saw. So it depends on where you're sitting. But from the stage, it is small and it's a chant, but it's big enough that it's not like, you know, you're playing for the family. So it's big enough that you can project out to the far corner. I brought 12 people on stage there before with horns and the whole shebang. So it accommodates whatever it has to accommodate. And I liked it because I was, a really big rising star, and I liked to claim what I had always known and say, this is who I am. I'm not going to be so big that you have to see me in a stadium. You can always see me at the Roxy. We booked two shows, and then we booked a late show for both nights. And so that was why this time I booked a late show as well, just to celebrate that old exhausting idea.
Was it exhausting for you?
It was, but I seemed to have unlimited energy in those days. I was just so excited, and the audiences were very vocal. There's a there's a recording, I think, of My Funny Valentine or something, and somebody goes, whatever he yelled, woo, blah, blah, blah. And he's on the recording, and that's what it was like. It was alive, visceral. And because it's that small, you know, I don't know about other people's audiences, but my audience, you know, really interacted with me. And I needed that when I was a kid. I needed constant, we still love you like we did a minute ago. You're still okay.
Let's talk about the album that you recorded there and hear a little bit from the early 1980s. Can we do that?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, my funny Valentine. My sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile. It's my heart. Baby, you know your looks. It is unphotographable.
You never know why they're laughing.
But wow. Still, that's beautiful. Why'd you choose the Roxy for that recording?
I chose the Roxy because it was, you know, I could pack it full of the numbers of a larger place. Or it would feel that way, and so it would be exciting. But why did I pick it? It's a good place to play. The waitresses are nice. They don't come up to the front of the room when you're singing that note. Come on, hey. So they were, it was a good place. And there's always the secret rumor of possible movie stars out there somewhere, so that made it more thrilling.
You had some run-ins with all kinds of folks at the Roxy over the years, didn't you? On the scene there. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, there are some photographs from the first shows, where that seem to be full of all the comedians. So I guess they put the, you know, when they are asking for free tickets, they put them all at the same show. So Mary Kay Place came back. There used to be a picture of her, and she's kind of stayed a friend through the years. Pee Wee Herman. Dressed up like Pee-wee, and then Robin Williams came back, and you know, when I met Robin, I can be quite shy, and I took off my hat and was shuffling as I spoke, and he did the same thing back to me. He was so brilliant and so humane, you know, in his humor. We became friends. But my favorite memory was around 1990, and I finished the show and I was walking up the stairs where there's not supposed to be anybody there. That's that sacred thing where you're walking on or walking off. This guy appears at the top of the stairs and I'm like, I'm about to go, hey man, what are you doing?
Who was it?
He takes off his hat and takes off his glasses and he says, Ricky, it's Jack. It was Jack Nicholson. That was so cool.
He pulled himself away from the Lakers game, yeah, in the hardwood just to go to the Roxy to see you.
So he came to see me quite a few times, and I never had gotten to meet him. But that night, at least I got a it's Jack.
Hey, over the years, you know, the scene on the Strip turned to punk, hard rock. We're talking hair bands, Guns N' Roses, and hair metal. Women didn't feature quite as prominently, if at all, during those years. I'm talking about the 80s, obviously. Tell me a little bit about that. What happened?
You know, I think at the middle or end of the 70s, the pop music that was, that genealogy, however you say it, up till then, it was just ending. And it didn't have any branches. Or it didn't seem to. So all of the scenes on the Strip and anywhere else, they were just dire and dead. I lived in Venice, and there were a few cool folk clubs with sparks of where it might go. So it was anybody's game, right? And everybody was let into the clubs because you had to, some of those bands had to pay to play. And bring in numbers. I mean, it got really gross for a while. And the Whiskey became the place where maybe legitimate punk played, but the Troubadour was where it was happening. The Troubadour was open every night. So that's how people like the Minutemen and Black Flag found their way in among the hair bands and eventually took that over. It became the place to see punk rock music. I was hanging out there, but I wouldn't play there because that wasn't, you know, that wasn't my scene. You might think, well, if you play there, it's your scene. But it was naturally inviting some other. And there were no women. It just was, you know, Linda Ronstadt, people might not remember, but she was the only woman that had seemed to have legitimacy. Linda was kind of the queen, and women were not invited. And you'd see a few women who kind of imitated men. They dress like them, or you know, because that's one way in, is if you pretend to be, you disguise yourself like a virus and you get in. But for me, just bringing it back to me, I went, well, there's a big space here for a woman who looks like a woman and acts like a woman and doesn't try to be anything else, is a little weird. I'll bet you I can walk up on that stage. You know, the first times there were some boos, but I just held on, and eventually people went, yeah. And it opens the door for other people to define their own way that they want to go.
You got shows coming up at the Roxy, as you mentioned, as part of this 50-year celebration. Are you going to be revisiting some of those songs that you played there?
I am. I have two shows. The first show, because it can't go on too long, because, you know, most of the audience is older and they want to go to bed. So you got to get on there at 10:30. But for that second show, but it's focusing on the jazz of the jazz record, the record that came out in April. I have an extraordinary young band. And then I'll be putting in, I may put in one or two songs that I haven't recorded yet that I've been working on. And for sure, The Last Chance Texaco, or those songs that people love to hear. So that's pretty much what it will be, more or less, focusing on jazz at least half the time. So, you know, I probably won't do My Funny Valentine, but now that you played that, I have to go see if I can muster up the ability to sing it without crying. So.
Are you serious? Have we changed your mind? Did we do something to prod you to do the Valentine's? Because that would be amazing.
Yes, but what if people compare it? What if they go, oh, look, she doesn't hit that note that way anymore. And what about that? Then you go, I don't want to make it sad for them. I want it always to be powerful and full of sunlight, right? Full of the power of light. And if they become worried about you because of your age, then it's a totally different experience for them. So if I felt like I could do, and maybe not the big notes, which I can do once in a while, but if I felt like it would be as emotionally evocative, I would give it a go. Yes. So out loud, I'm saying maybe there'll be a Valentine.
Ricky Lee Jones, what an honor to have you on. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for celebrating the Roxy. You know, what makes L.A. what it is are those clubs and those places that are part of our lives.
Joining us now to talk some more about the Roxy is Cisco Adler, musician, songwriter, and producer. He also happens to be the son of Lou Adler, who started the club all those years ago. Hey, Cisco.
How we doing?
We're doing all right. Ricky Lee and I are talking about her big event in October, October 18th. Talk a little bit about what else is coming up. We had Neil Young, which we talked about as well. What else is happening for the 50th anniversary celebration?
Yeah. Neil was incredible, obviously, almost transcendental. But we had Stephen Marley a couple nights after that. We had the Wallows. We just announced the 1975 in October. And then a couple more that I can't speak of just yet.
Oh, you have some surprises.
I mean, we like to keep a couple surprises after 50 years.
any hints?
No, look, I think it's been, you know, we have a lot of history with a lot of bands, and especially from around here. So I would say look out for some locals who have done amazing things and are coming back around.
All right. You are 5 years younger than the Roxy, right?
I am. And 5 years younger than my older brother, who was born, parallel to
that
the
year. Yeah. I assume, though, growing up, you spent plenty of time there. What are some of your favorite memories?
It's funny because as a kid, wherever you are is just wherever you are, right? Mine just happened to be the Roxy and the Sunset Strip. But looking back now, I think it was that sort of Showtime era of the Lakers and the music that was going on at that time. And it was a swirl of crazy culture around there. So seeing all those faces that now I look back and are not only legends, but heroes of mine as I've done my homework, you know?
How would you describe the scene today along the Sunset Strip? I mean, is there a way to describe it? Is it the same as it once was?
No, I mean, is the strip ever the same? Look, it's gone through shifts in culture. It's gone through shifts in sort of mainstream music, right, over the years, and that always happens. So whatever is on the strip, and more specifically, whatever's at the Roxy, is usually the pulse of what's breaking right now, you know. So I think if you're going there to see the younger bands that are on the precipice of breaking and have just gotten to the point that they can sell out the Roxy, I think that's what's always been exciting about the size of the club and about the scene that gathers around those young Rolling Stones as they gather moss, you know.
Cisco Adler, musician, songwriter, producer, son of Lou Adler, who started the club so many years ago. Happy 50th to the Roxy and to your family.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you. And everyone, come on by for the celebration.
There's much more of Greater LA to come. Just ahead, mapping the culture and history of some areas all around the LA River in an effort to remember how those neighborhoods evolved. That's yours after this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. In recent years, gentrification and development have had big impacts on some LA neighborhoods. Take, for example, the communities that line the LA River, like Atwater Village and Glassell Park. Once affordable, working-class enclaves, they now have trendy coffee shops and breweries popping up on every block. Well, as these areas continue to change, is there a way to hang on to local history and culture? One nonprofit in Frogtown is trying to, by way of an ever-evolving cultural atlas. Sue Bell Yank is the executive director of what's called Clock Shop, which just launched the storytelling and mapping project called Take Me to Your River. And she's with us right now to tell us more about it. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Steve.
So, of course, that's a play off of the famous song. Break it down for me. What exactly is a cultural atlas? And why'd you want to create one for that stretch of the LA River?
Well, it's a 3-year collective history project. And so the idea is that, you know, we're really sharing and celebrating the diverse experiences of those who call Northeast LA home and have for a really long time. The river, of course, is a central thread throughout these communities. And so we're particularly interested in the stories of people living around that kind of central thread who've taken a really active role in shaping their neighborhoods and communities over time, and that come from the primarily working class communities of color that characterize these neighborhoods.
When you navigate this atlas, you can click on a map to hear from a bunch of different locals, right, talking about those experiences.
Yes, that's exactly right. So we have an interactive website at takemetoyourriver.org. It features a timeline, a map, and then there's also a stories section. So you can see people in the actual geographies that they're talking about, you know, giving their personal lived experiences of those places. But we also have included photographs, short videos, and some archival research, too, just to get more of a historical context of those neighborhoods.
And you also talk to other people as well. I want to play an interview that you did. This is with a person named Yancy Quinones, owner of Antigua Coffee House. And here he is talking about his childhood growing up in Cypress Park.
Cypress Park was a small town. You had the butcher. You had a bunch of little stores that you didn't have to go anywhere else. We had, like, before the Home Depot, there was a place right there in the corner of Arvia and Cypress Avenue. It was a hardware store. You went there. It was a small town that I grew up in. Everything was around the area, so you had no need to go anywhere else.
How did you find folks like Yancy to share their stories for this project, and what kind of conversations did you have?
Clock Shop has been in Elysian Valley for 20 years now, and our mission has been always to deepen the connection between communities and public land. And so we really started with the people that we knew, and we're thinking of it like concentric circles in that we started with a pilot, you know, and Yancy was one of the folks who was recommended to us early on from an existing relationship. But now that we have the website up, we're really looking to expand all of the narratives over the next 3 years and have more and more people be a part of this project.
As we keep talking about, gentrification has been that big issue in communities all up and down the river, but throughout much of LA for that matter. Let's hear from Helen Lung, who's founder of the community organization LA Mas, talking about how it's playing out in her neighborhood.
The culture I see most at risk in Frogtown is the longtime culture that isn't obvious or presented as newer developments in Market Frogtown as a cool, hip place to be. And to me, that's the diversity of working class renters, many who are undocumented, many who are renters, that are immigrants from all over Latin America and Southeast Asia.
What do you think, Sue, is the impact of a project like this? And what can it be in communities where a lot of folks have either been displaced or they're at risk of being priced out of the market altogether in those areas?
I think that's just a huge dynamic that we've been seeing, you know, and a real sense of urgency that we feel around capturing and exploring these stories, many of which, as Helen was saying, are hidden or haven't really been recognized as broadly. I am not originally from LA, but I've lived here for 2 decades now, and it's so easy to just drive through places, you know, to bounce from one trendy coffee shop or bar to another and not really consider the history and cultures of the places that you might be occupying, which I think divorces us a little from participation in our own communities. And we have kind of a learned helplessness as the city changes around us. But in doing this work, I have been so inspired by the people who really are embedded in their communities, like Helen, and have actively fought for the kind of neighborhoods, you know, that we need. So I hope that that piece and hearing some of these stories inspires people to, you know, really seek out ways that they can be part of their communities, support their communities, and to advocate for, you know, a different path for this city. I think many of us are increasingly frustrated with its continuing unlivability.
You plan on keeping this atlas going, right, and filling out the atlas over the next several years. How do folks get involved?
We do have a part of our website where you can submit a story or a recommendation from your community. Right now, our focus are the communities of Elysian Valley, Frogtown, Atwater Village, Cypress Park, and Glassell Park. You know, hopefully we can expand that someday. And we also will be doing a series of in-person public programs over the next few years involving local artists and community members as facilitators, organizers, and community historians, you know, stewarding these stories that people have entrusted us with.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. Sue Bell Yank, the executive director of Clock Shop, which just launched Take Me to Your River, a cultural atlas of the LA River. Find more, by the way, at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Sue, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Even more river now with Greater LA from KCRW, but this time the water is underground. Those are the sounds of an underground stream called North Branch, which flows under Highland Park. It's just one of many river and stream sounds showcased in a local project called Underflow LA. Jane Sung is the artist who's been recording those sounds of the underground waters, and she's here now to talk with us about it. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me here today.
A stream underground. So there are the sounds. That's the North Branch that you recorded in Highland Park. How did you get down there if it's flowing underground?
Okay, there's two different ways to access the North Branch. And one is one that many graffiti taggers know about, which is you go under this bridge, the bridge between Sycamore Grove Park and Dubs Park and Highland Park. Under that bridge, you'll see there's the outflow where the North Branch storm drain, which carries a lot of water that originates in Highland Park. So it's pretty much draining the most of the 90042 zip code. And so if you go to that bridge that connects Sycamore Grove Park and Dubs Park, you look down and there will be the outflow where the water draining the 90042 zip code comes out into the Arroyo Seco. And there is water there all the time. The other way to access it is there is a whole network of storm drains under our streets in Highland Park and Mount Washington. And so theoretically, one could lift up a manhole cover and look in. When we had the opportunity to look inside a manhole cover, one could hear the sound without even sticking your head, you know, in the manhole cover. You could hear the sound from the street. And once you get your head a little bit closer, you could feel the temperature was different down there. And the pipes were lined with brick. And so that was like, you know, this old school kind of craftsmanship that it was such a surprise to see that. But it was beautiful. I mean, the water is like music.
Why did you decide to do this? I mean, why did you take on this big project?
I mean, this water is flowing under our city all the time. This is a sound of nature that's produced by this landscape and is flowing under our city. And yet we don't have access to those sounds, you know, and in our everyday city lives where we're surrounded by the soundscape of like cars and, you know, machines and ice cream trucks and stuff. And so like this soundscape is under our city and it's the sound of nature, you know, like this is nature. We don't understand how the water gets there. And that's what's even more amazing about it. It's like the nature that happens even when we've tried to transform the landscape to be shed of water, you know, that nature is so powerful and it's around us all the time, even if we try to erase it. So it's kind of like, you know, people seek out the sound of water flowing and the healing sounds of nature. And this soundscape is always here. It's always under the city. It's happening all the time, whether I record it or not, right? So it was just kind of fun to bring that that thing that was invisible into a form where people can access it every day, right? Like you can be working and listen to the sound of the stream.
In your bio, Jane, you write, quote, "Our river water is a living archive of our urban lives. Even if you don't know of it, it already knows you." What does that mean? What are you saying there? It knows you.
It knows you because when the rain falls over the city, you know, it coats everything. Like it has no discrimination. It falls on everyone and everything that's outside, right? And when whatever it falls on, it picks up a chemical trace of that. So, for example, if it falls on an oak tree, you know, it's going to pick up some traces of the oaks and all of the life in the oaks. It'll soak into the ground, pick up traces of that. It'll interact with all the natural processes in the tree and in the soil. And maybe there's a process that some people call cleaning, right? Like in some way, water can be cleaned by natural processes in in soil with the microorganisms and stuff. It can also be that if the water falls on a car, you know, and over a street, that is going to pick up traces of everything that was on that street. And so by the time the water has made its way to the storm drain, like the outflow of the North Branch, it has picked up traces from all over the zip code of 90042. You know, like everything in the watershed, it has traces of all of that. And so that's why I say that the water has traces of you, even if we don't know that those streams exist.
We are all connected, though, as you say, Jane Song, river recorder, artist. Jane, thank you for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
By the way, you can find out more information about Underflow LA and Jane's work at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, a couple of locals from El Sereno are on a mission to support their community by opening a green grocery store and buying from local vendors. A big thank you for your support of public media and KCRW. We wrapped up our fall fundraiser, keeping what we do strong and healthy. If you didn't get that contribution in, however, you can still go to the website, kcrw.com/join, and give now. Again, thank you, thank you, thank you for everything that you've done in helping us out. And while you're at the website, tell us how you're doing, share a story idea you might have, grab the podcast too, all at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Rebecca Ludman, Ted Robbins, Sue Margulies, Mario Saavedra, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, Eben Ray, and Christian Bordall all helped run this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great night.